So we're at the end of the second day of our little retreat. How are things going for you? Are there questions that arise in practice about the themes?
I have a question.
Yes.
So the Buddha taught about the Brahma-viharas to dwell one quarter in each one.
Yeah.
But it seems like mudita gets really short shrift. Like teachers that I've heard talk about the Brahma-viharas tend to concentrate on metta and on compassion and on equanimity more so. And I'm just wondering, from your perspective, if that's a thing that's sort of exclusive to Vipassana in the U.S., or what that's about. Because it really seems like there's not a lot even written about mudita compared to some of the other Brahma-viharas.
It is a Western phenomena. I think in Asia, when the Brahma-viharas are taught, they're taught metta, mudita, metta, karuna, mudita, upeka. They're taught all four. So I think it is... you can't hear me? No. Thank you. I haven't lived in the East, but when I've spoken to people who have lived in the East, who do live in the East, who teach in the East... That's what they're saying, is that when they talk about the Brahma-viharas, they talk about all four of them. So I think the reason why the reason why it's short shrift here in the States is because metta, karuna, and upeka are obviously in need. But the reality is, with mudita, in order to actually practice mudita, you know, you need to put down your own self interests, your self needs. You need to put down the kind of whole negative emotional world that's flowing through you in order to connect up with the joy of somebody else's joy. So it actually is a sophisticated practice. And to manage it, then it brings a lot of well-being. So it's an important practice. Yeah. And it's an interesting thing just to contemplate, like determining mudita as a day where one goes through the day and tries to bring one's attention to the joy in other people's joy. You know? Did I tell you when I was here last time about there was a monk who had a very traumatic experience. He went and his father had committed suicide, and he'd found his father, okay? So every time he thought of his father, his whole system went into shock. Did I share that? Yeah. And then what he decided to do, because, you know, he'd think about his dad and his whole system would go into a trauma shock response, is that he decided that he was going to deliberately think of ways to bring joy to people, and set it up so that whenever he did do that, he could be around when they had discovered that he had done it for them. And when he watched their faces kind of light up, he would say, "That's for you, Dad." Okay? So it was a way of... It's actually very skillful. I mean, it's not the end of the story, and there's usually quite a lot of shock and trauma and anger and rage still that needs to get navigated through, but... What he was doing was he was replacing the shock and trauma response with a joy response. And then it took a month or two of him doing this at every moment that he could to transfer a trauma response into something where his whole being would light up with joy. You know, so he'd think of his dad, and then all that he would feel is the joy of everyone else's reaction when he would do something to help them and then transfer the merit towards them. So, you know, there are many people in our society who suffer from difficult emotions, depression and low self-esteem, and these are difficult things to work with. And yet, working with joy in this kind of a way where we're deliberately bringing joy to other people, and then allowing that to suffuse our own sense of well-being, is a skillful strategy. Yes. Well, that's been my life strategy for the last, I don't know how many years, I'm a suppressive anger type. And so, I had to come up with very specific permission strategies to allow myself to tolerate feeling angry, because I would suppress it before I even knew I was angry, okay? I mean, I had it really under wraps. And so when I started to realize how destructive that was as destructive as it was dumping it on other people, then I needed to find another way. And so I needed to come up with ways to allow myself to tolerate the experience of anger without dumping it on people and without suppressing it. And then there was a period of time when I did cathartic practices. And I remember the first time I did this, I was terrified. Okay, absolutely terrified. I was in Switzerland. It was in the middle of the winter retreat. It was 15 degrees below zero centigrade. And I went out with my incense sticks, and I went out with candles, and I made a protective circle, and I said, may this be for the benefit of all beings. And what I did was I took some rocks, and I said some swear words, and I threw them, really scary. And I was petrified because there was something so scary for me to tolerate feeling anger in my body and expressing it, even though I had set it up so that nobody would get hurt. Just to even do something like that was really pushing my comfort zones. So then I could feel what it felt like to allow anger and to express it in a way where no one was getting hurt and it wasn't actually getting jammed into my system, okay? And then slowly, I'm not great at it. I'm better at it, but I'm not great at it. Allowing the experience of anger to arise in awareness and tolerate that, okay? Not raging at somebody means not dumping your anger on them, but it doesn't mean that one is not allowed to feel anger. Yeah. So one of the things that we need to learn to develop is the way to interpret whatever it is we're hearing in terms of our specific kind of conditioning, okay? So suppressive types like myself around anger need permission. Expressive types are people who tend to dump or to rip or to let go or, they need to hold. They need to contain, okay? So, our conditioning is different, and it'll be different around different things, yeah. But what's important is neither to suppress nor to dump. And so, if a person is feeling raging, then obviously they're not having a problem feeling rage. Yeah. So that's why that instruction in that situation was in that way. Yeah. But if you come to me and say, listen, I find it really impossible just to even feel angry, then my instruction would be completely different. I'd have you out there with the rocks. Punch in water. Go off with your car, roll up the windows and say some of those big, bad, naughty words, as loud and as important and as powerfully as you can, because one needs to kind of allow it through our body systems to get a feeling of what that feels like, and that nobody got hurt, nobody died, you're okay, it's all right. You can actually survive the experience of expressing anger and not die. I think that's why I was so terrified. you know.
That doesn't sound like a Buddhist practice to me, though. That's
well,
more like in the 70s or 80s, punch pillows or whatever it was.
I think, you know, we have all kinds of ideas about what Buddhist practice is, and some of them are right and some of them are not right. Buddhist practice is about approaching suffering, understanding it, and releasing it. Okay? And it's true in terms of meditation practice. Meditation practice is not psychological practice. Okay? It doesn't enter into the territory and interact with it. Okay? On some levels, it observes it. All right? But what I found in my life is that, you know, I was absolutely committed Buddhist practitioner, and I was still miserable as sin. And so what I realized is that there was this huge area of psychological work that wasn't happening because of my dedicated Buddhist practice. And the result of that was is there was an enormous amount of suffering. So my bottom line is I'm interested in understanding suffering and the end of suffering, and I don't care. All right? I don't care if it's psychological or if it's gender or if it's sociological or if it's political. I don't care. What I'm interested in is touching it and meeting it and understanding it and releasing it. And what I have found is that some of these different kinds of suffering requires different kinds of antidotes. So the transpersonal ending of suffering, which is what meditation is brilliant for, is almost completely ineffectual for some of these other kinds of suffering.
Thank you for saying
that. All right? And so, you know, what happens, like for somebody in my situation where our whole life, my whole life is dedicated to the practice, you know, there's this hope. If I just practice harder, if I just do it harder, if I just am more dedicated and do it more, if I sit more, if I spend more time alone on my cushion, then I will find the answer to all of these other forms of suffering. And it doesn't work. So I'm a realist, in addition to being a drama queen. And so for me, it's like, you know, I've spent 20 years of my life working as hard as I can in a practice with as much dedication as I can muster. And it is not giving me the skills that I need to work with some of the stuff that I have to work with. So I go and find the resources that can help me. You know, one of the things that we're in the middle of right now is a war. I don't know if you've noticed. But there's a gender war going on, okay? And, you know, for 2,500 years, we have had the most incredible Dhamma Vinaya that you can imagine, okay? And we have enlightened masters. But that is not enough to illuminate cultural biases and prejudice that get passed on according to cultural biases through generations. It doesn't see it, it doesn't address it, and it doesn't eradicate it. Well, enough is enough. So for me, I can see that this kind of suffering is actually a suffering that is not supportive of awakening. And so I feel very clear and committed. It's enough. It's time to move out of that. How? I'm not quite sure yet how, but I'm clear that we got to go that way. Yeah. And that's true with all kinds of suffering. You know, there's a lot of people who come to the monastery who've got major issues around sexual orientation. You know? So celibacy is the solution. Right. Right. It's like, no. You know, sexual orientation needs to be sorted out. And whether you choose to be celibate or not is a separate topic. But you have to feel comfortable with who you are and how your energies flow. You know? So,
to me, on the other side of that is, when do you take action? Right? So you've seen sexism. When do you take action? You know, I'm struggling with this issue with my brother. Constantly hoping that I will come to God. And there's a way in which I just want to say, that's enough. You know, so that it's not with hate, but there is a way in which I feel it would be helpful for me to just say, that's enough. I don't want to hear that.
So for me, you know, I had this view that if I meditated hard enough, I would become enlightened and that would solve all my problems. And so the conviction was that if one just surrenders sufficiently to the meditation and to the form, that that will be the panacea that is going to solve everything, all right? When I knew in my bone marrow that it wasn't because I wasn't meditating correctly, and it wasn't because I wasn't doing it hard enough, but there was other things that needed to be attended to that required another approach, then that gave me the courage to begin to look and question the things that were taboo to question, all right? And with that came the confidence to say, this is enough. But until I doubted, until I thought that if I only surrender enough, then I didn't have the confidence to say that's enough because I thought that there was something wrong with the level of my practice and understanding. And once I got it, that that's not where the problem was, then the courage and the strength came. And it wasn't nasty, but it was ferocious. This is enough. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I know this is practice, but is there a process for just feeling whatever it is? I call them stuck thought forms in my body that I haven't been able to release, you know, like anger or fear. And just the regular things we've been doing, will that release them?
So there's the yes answer and then there's the no answer. So the yes answer is yes, that this actually does work and it actually is very helpful. And a lot of people find a lot of relief and a lot of liberation that comes from just doing the practice. The no answer is that there's some aspects of our own mind-body psychology which is kind of resistant to attention and awareness. And those kind of places often need other support in addition to meditation practice. And for me, the sign of a mature practitioner is somebody who's able to recognize that. So they use meditation in the ways that support them, and they see the limitations of it and the places in their own mind-body system that it's not sufficient, and then they get appropriate support that addresses the insufficiency. So is that enough for a day? Yeah? Okay. So I'd like to just close. Which chants did I pass out? Namo Tassa, the sharing of blessings. Let's do the sharing of blessings chant. So one word just before we do the sharing of blessings chant. Often is the case that people think that the amount of blessings that they have is dependent on the content of their experience. Okay? So if you're feeling light or energetic, if you're feeling very loving, if you're feeling very resourced, then you have a lot of blessings. But in a way, it's actually not the right way of looking at it, because the content of our experience is not as significant as the aspiration to awaken. And so, you know, some people might have had a hard day today. You know, they might have felt frustrated or low or aggravated, irritated. And it's not helpful to judge the amount of blessings we have by the content of what it is that we're experiencing. It is rare in this world that people have the aspiration to awaken, that they make time to sit quietly, to contemplate, and to be present with what's arising, even if what's arising is unpleasant. Yeah. So to have access to teachings and to have community, to have silence, to have support, to have an opportunity to practice is a phenomenal blessing. So touch that when we're doing this chant, rather than the content of the kind of things that were arising during the day.